The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue here, taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 21st day of May. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way, and we've got a great show lined up for you tonight, as usual. Up first, we'll welcome in former New York Ranger, the great Pete Stemkowski, and in the second half, we'll speak to former Cardinal and Met pitcher and outfielder, Rick Ankiel. He'll join us, and we'll talk about his new book, The Phenomenon. So sit back, relax, enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. We've got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page called Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, and then you can click and give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, over 15 seasons, my first guest played for the Toronto Maple Leafs, Detroit Red Wings, New York Rangers, and the LA Kings. He's best remembered for his heroics in the 1970-71 Stanley Cup semifinals, when he scored two overtime goals for the Rangers in an eventual series loss to the Blackhawks. He won the Stanley Cup in 1967, however, with the Toronto Maple Leafs. I welcome into Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Pete Stemkowski. Pete, good evening.
Yeah, hi, Bill. How are you?
Great.
How's everything going?
Wonderful, Pete. It's great to have you with us tonight.
Thank you.
Now, you were a center, Pete. You were known as one of the top face-off players in the NHL. How did you hone your skills to be known as that particular type of player?
Well, I like to think that I was probably, you know, known for more than just winning face-offs.
Sure,
You know, 15 years in the NHL, and I think that, you know, everybody who reaches that plateau, whether it be in Major League Baseball or whether it be in the National Football League, the National Basketball Association, and we're talking about the National Hockey League, you always want to win a championship, and you always want to go out with a Stanley Cup. So, you know, winning a Stanley Cup was certainly a big thrill for me. But you know, as far as face-offs concerned, you know, I don't know. I just thought that, you know, it's me against the other guy.
Sure.
And, when they drop the puck, somebody has to win the face-off. So I just studied a little bit more, concentrated a little bit more, and, you know, I was probably fortunate enough to win more than I lost. So that was a pretty good stat as far as my career was concerned.
Sure was, definitely. Now, you were a product of the Toronto Maple Leafs junior system. You played in your native Winnipeg before moving to Toronto at the age of 17 to play with the Marlboros. Talk a little bit about your junior days, Peter.
Well, you know, you've certainly done your homework. You know, I grew up in Winnipeg, Manitoba, where the winters probably still are, as they were back then, about 10 below, you know, wind chill factor. So probably till I was about 12 or 13 years old, I never played in an indoor rink. It was, you know, basically get a shovel, let's get rid of the snow, and let's get a hose, and let's put some water down, and the water froze, and that's where I skated. And, you know, I was pretty fortunate growing up. I was, you know, skilled at hockey. I was a pretty good baseball player and football player. I mean, you know, I was given those talents. That I was good at athletics. And, you know, Bill, I was around high school. I was really. They said, "You want to play some football, maybe, or you want to go on and play hockey?" And that was a little bit of a decision that I had to make. And I spoke to a counselor in high school back then. I always remember his name was John Potter. He was the football coach at my high school in Winnipeg. And he said, "You know something, Pete? If you're going to do something in this world with athletics, you're better off to play hockey. Because in football, I mean, one play, one knee, and a very limited career. So why don't you go on and play hockey?" So I played a couple of years at 16 years of age, junior, for the Winnipeg Monarchs. And then came the Toronto Marlies, came knocking on my door and said, "Listen, Pete, we think you're good enough to play with the bigger boys, the better boys in Toronto." So at 17 years of age, you know, just wet behind the ears, white socks. I was a real hit coming out of Winnipeg, and I went there, and I left Winnipeg, and that was probably one of the biggest decisions I made in my life. I went to Winnipeg, went to Toronto, and then the rest is history. But if I hadn't left Winnipeg and gone to Toronto, I probably never would have accomplished anything that I did, as far as my hockey career was concerned.
Definitely, sure. Now, you split your first three professional seasons, Pete, between the Leafs and the farm team in Rochester. Was that called the Americans then?
Well, no, yeah, that was the Amerks. We won the Memorial Cup back in the early 60s, and we had a great junior team back then. I think out of about 70 games, we must have lost 10 or 12. We had people like Wayne Carlton and Ronnie Ellis played on that team, Gary Suitcase Smith and myself, and my line of Ronnie Ellis and Wayne Carlton, we all had over 100 points that year. We won the Memorial Cup, and then I turned 20, so I was finished as far as juniors concerned, and I signed a professional contract with the Toronto Maple Leafs. And at that time, Bill, they had a Central Hockey League team, the Tulsa Oilers, and they had a team in Rochester called the Rochester Americans, the Amerks.
Right.
And about a half a dozen guys turned pro from that junior team, and then four of them went to Tulsa. And at training camp, I said to Punch Imlach, who was then our general manager, I said, my guys that play in junior, they're going to Tulsa. I wouldn't mind going with them. No. He said, you're going to Rochester. And I goes, why is that? And he says, well, we want you close, just in case there's a situation here in Toronto. We need to call somebody up. Rochester's a lot closer. So I was disappointed. Gary Smith, who was our goalie in junior, and myself went to Rochester, where it was an older team, and the rest of my guys went to Tulsa. So I spent a little bit of time down in the American Hockey League with Rochester.
Sure. Now, you made the Leafs squad in 66-67. Now, they win the cup that year, Pete, your first year. Most of the focus...
Well, not really.
No?
No, I got up there. I got called up a couple of games prior to that.
Okay.
Bits and pieces. So, yeah, but that 66, 67, that was the year we did win the cup. You're right. You're right on that one. Yeah.
Most of the focus, though, goes to guys like Terry Sawchuk, Hall of Famer, Johnny Bauer, Hall of Famer, yeah. George Armstrong, the great Frank Mihaljevic, Timmy Horton. Tell us a little bit about playing with those guys.
Well, first of all, when I was growing up in junior, when I was, 15, 16 years old, everybody has somebody you look up to when you're playing at that level, even lower. And Frank Mihaljevic was always the guy. I mean, I had visions of Frank Mihaljevic. He's the guy that I really idolized and cared about. And lo and behold, half a dozen years later or so, I'm on the ice, with Frank Mihaljevic. But back then, it's a lot different than the National Hockey League today than it was back then. When you graduated out of junior and you went to the professional league, you had to prove yourself to these people. And I remember you going down to Rochester, and I was very successful down there. I think at Christmas, or I was leading the league in scoring, or tied or near the top as far as scoring was concerned. Then I was brought up to the Toronto Maple Leafs, and back then you mentioned the Frank Mihaljevic's and the George Armstrong's, Bob Pulford, those kind of people. Mm-hmm. That was an old team. In fact, that team we won in 66, 67, I believe, and you correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's the oldest team that's ever has won the Stanley Cup. So here comes a 22, 23-year-old kid in with guys that are close to 30 years of age. So I had to prove myself with those guys. And when I stepped in the locker room, those press clippings I had from junior, it really didn't mean much. I had to prove myself, and I barely got a good morning or a hello out of these guys. But once I showed these guys, the George Armstrongs and the Dave Keons and the Bob Pulfords of the world, that I could play at that level, then I was accepted. But I always say, Bill, when I played 15 years in the National Hockey League and with the Rangers and Los Angeles and Detroit, and if I wrote a book today, probably half of that book could be on that team, that 1967 team, because that was a tremendous learning experience for me. And we had a reunion this year back on New Year's, January 1st. 50 years. It's been 50 years.
Oh, boy, yeah.
It's the Toronto Maple Leafs that won the Stanley Cup, and we were a part of it. So we had a little bit of a celebration back there a couple of months back.
Outstanding. Well, we're talking to Pete Stemkowski tonight on Sports Talk 1240. A great club, definitely, Peter. Now, how did you feel about leaving Toronto and getting sent to Detroit in the Frank Mihaljevic deal?
Yeah, well, you know, that was unusual because after we won the Cup, they expanded. They went to 12 teams. And, you know, when we won the Stanley Cup, I played with Bob Pulford and Jimmy Papin.
Right.
And next year we came into camp and suddenly I'm not playing with those guys anymore. And I never could figure that out. We had such a great finish and we won the Cup. We go into training camp in Peterborough the following year and I'm not even playing with these guys. And we had a down year. So it was a year where we lost a lot of people. We lost some key guys through the expansion. Sochek was gone. A couple of other guys were gone, and we had some young people, those guys in Tulsa that I mentioned earlier. They were ready to jump into the National Hockey League. So that team kind of disbanded. I was not having a good year at that point. The team wasn't having a good year. And then in March, their Pontiac, who our coach and general manager at the time, pulled the trigger. And he traded myself, Gary Unger, and Mihaljevic to Detroit, you know, for Henderson, Floyd Smith and Normie Ullman.
Right.
It was my first trade, and when you get traded for the first time, it shakes you up a little bit. But it was part of life, and we accepted it, and we moved on, you know, to the Detroit Red Wings.
Right. Yeah, you responded well, Pete. I mean, you had two 20-plus goal seasons in Detroit. You get to play with more immortal guys like Gordie Howe, Alex Delvecchio.
Yeah.
Future teammates, Bruce McGregor and Dale Rolfe, right?
Yep. Yeah. It was quite an experience, you know, playing with the Toronto Maple Leafs. We had a Pontiac who was he was a stickler for practices, hard practices, hour and a half, sprints, up, down, you know, and he was a yeller, a screamer. If he didn't like the way things were going, was, you know, put the pucks in the nets and let's do a couple of laps kind of thing. And
yeah.
Then, you know, we went to Detroit when Sid Abel was the guy running the show there, and, you know, the practices were the really lackadaisical, you know, half hour, a couple of line rushes here, there, and off the ice, and, you know, I had some great moments. I loved my time in Detroit. It's a tremendous sports town, even today. I mean, every sports team has their own venue, their own place. Detroit, the Tigers play in their own place, the Lions play, the Pistons have their own place, you know, the Red Wings are building a new arena, it'll be ready next year. So I had a great time in Detroit. I had a chance to, you know, to rub shoulders with Gordie Howe, Alex Delvecchio,
right.
Gary Bergman, Roger Crozier. The years I had there were great. It was a great community. I lived with Gary Unger at the time, and, you know, we didn't have the horses there. And then eventually, Ned Harkness came on the scene. A college coach, and he tried to, you know, kind of institute the college mentality into a professional team like the Red Wings, and I guess he didn't like me at all, so I ended up, you know, after a couple of years there, getting traded to the New York Rangers.
Right, you should get sent to the Rangers for Larry Brown. Yeah, Harkness must have had a problem with you because he sent you off packing. The Rangers now, they're coming off a couple of lean years, but now the team's developing. You join the squad. They got a good mix of veterans, in New York there with, Gilbert, Rattel, Eddie Jacobin, and some younger guys like Park, Vickers, Tkachuk. And, you were very popular with the Garden faithful, weren't you, Pete?
Well, it was a little bit of experience. You know, if you grew up in Winnipeg in Canada and you go to Toronto, then you go to Detroit, you know, it's nothing like then you come to, you know, a city with 8 million people. So,
yeah.
Not only was it, you know, once you get on the ice, it's 200 by 85. You drop the puck and you play hockey. You know, it doesn't matter what city you're in, but, you know, the off ice kind of thing, driving to practice, getting a place to live. So that, you know, that was the, you know, getting traded, to Detroit was a little bit of a shock for me because, I was having some good years in Detroit. I really was. I always thought, especially in my Detroit, in my Toronto years, I was more of a physical player and Detroit was not really a pretty kind of a soft team. We were talented and I was one guy that would throw my weight around a little bit. So, you know, I thought I was pretty safe in Detroit. So when I got traded to the Rangers, I was pretty shook up about it. And it took a couple of days for me to think it over. But, you know, I came here and I landed in LaGuardia Airport. Somebody picked me up, took me to Long Beach, and that was back in the early 70s, some 50 whatever years ago it was. And you know, I'm talking to you right now, Bill. I'm in Long Beach, New York. So it's a wonder how things work out. A phone call, a trade, a pickup, Long Beach, and somewhat 40 plus years later, here I am.
Exactly.
You know, making my home in Long Beach, New York.
Exactly. Yeah. Now the coach, of course, another Hall of Famer, the great Emil Francis. My dad used to take us down, Peter, to Skateland in on Hillside Avenue in New Hyde Park to watch the team practice, and there was the cat out there with his jacket on and whistle. You guys doing sprints? Oh, it was a great time down in New Hyde Park, I'll tell you.
Yeah, well, Emil was, I've been in this game a long time. I'm still involved. You know, I do work for the Rangers now. I do some radio for them. You know, I played for all those teams that we talked about. I've done some broadcasting with great people, with the Alberts, Marv Albert, Kenny Albert, and Sam Rose, and I've worked for all of them, and I'm involved with coaches and general managers and players. And, you know, this day when somebody asks me the top five people that I've ever met in this game, and, you know, I turned professional in the early 60s, so we're talking about a lot of years and a lot of players. And Emil Francis, if I have to pick out probably the top five of the best and the most respected people that I have ever come across or associated this game, Emil Francis has to be at the top. He was just a solid guy, a good human being, and he cared about his players. That's the big thing. You know, one thing is, you know, blow the whistle and do the job for me. If you don't, you're gone. But you know, he cared about what you did off the ice. If there was a problem, you know, he was there for you. And he's still alive. He's around 90 years of age, Emil. He's living down in Florida. We don't see him too often. He doesn't come up here too much because of the health of his wife. But people say when they go down to Florida, they have lunch with him, and he still tells those old stories. So he's still going strong, and I have the highest respect for Emil the Cat Francis.
They were some wonderful teams back then, and there I was, a kid waiting outside the locker room door with my little memo pen, and you guys would treat the fans wonderfully, and I'll never forget that. Now let's talk about the one of the biggest goals in Ranger history, Pete. Triple overtime, Game 6 of the Stanley Cup semifinals at the Garden. It forced the seventh game between the Rangers and the Blackhawks. Talk a little bit about the evening right there.
Well, it's, it certainly has come along with me all these years. I mean, you know, when I meet people, you know, I'm known for something, you know.
Yeah.
Especially in New York. I'm known for the triple overtime goal. And, you know, a lot of people come up to me and, you know, it makes me feel low when they say, you know, I was just a young kid and I had school next day and my parents said, look, shut it off because you got school tomorrow. And they would crawl underneath the covers and get their transistor radios, you know, to the ear and listen to it. So, Stan Mikita hit the goalpost twice. He hit the post and it rolled across the goal line, hit the other post, and we iced it. And then Bill White came in and hit Eddie Jackman in the throat with a shot. And, I don't know, it was around midnight or so, and Tim Horton, the late Tim Horton, came in, shot it in, and, you know, I happened to pick up the rebound and put it in. So it was a special night that night, but, you know, unfortunately it didn't really lead to anything that, you know, that we were happy about after that. We went into Chicago the following weekend, and we ended up losing, but people still have memories of that triple overtime goal, so I'm flattered when they come up to me and then they mention it to me and we talk about it a little bit. So that's a memory that will stay with me forever.
Certainly. Now, those great Ranger clubs during that time with Hall of Famers like Rattel and Gilbert and Park and Jockeman, they made the finals once, that club, but didn't get much further. What do you think held that team back? It couldn't have been the coach. It couldn't have been the strength of the players on the ice, Peter. What do you think held that club back from winning a Stanley Cup?
Well, I think the one year we ran it. Well, a couple of things. I think the one year we could have won it was Jean Rattel got hurt, and he was near the top of the scoring in the National Hockey League, and that gag line was just outstanding with Hatfield and Rod Gilbert. Dale Roof took a shot from the point. He hit it's Johnny Rotella, the ankle. He was down. He came back late in the playoffs, but he was, you know, nowhere near himself. And you know, I think that was certainly a factor. I don't want to use it as an excuse. And then, you know, another thing, I think, you know, we ran into a guy that, probably one of, if you want to put one of the great hockey players of all time, Bobby Orr.
Yeah.
When they beat us in 72 in the finals, I think it went six games and, Boston beat us. And, you know, there's nothing worse than having to shake hands with a team that beats you for the Stanley Cup on your home ice. And, you know, had we had a Rattel and had we had, not have to go against a guy like Bobby, or I think if you could have pushed those things aside a little bit, we might have had a little bit of a clearer path and, you know, might have won a Stanley Cup. And, you know, I had 15 years in the National Hockey League. I was fortunate to win a Stanley Cup in Toronto. I got some great memories of the people I played with in Toronto, but the one regret, and there shouldn't be one, but the one regret I do have is we never won a Stanley Cup with the New York Rangers, and that would have been fantastic. We came close, but, you know, as you mentioned, a couple of things just didn't go our way, and it just didn't happen.
Right, yeah, and as we said, Peter Stemkowski with us tonight, Sports Talk 1240. Some real great Ranger clubs during that time period under the cat Emil Francis, and just a great bunch of guys. Now, you had a great seven-season run with New York, three straight 20-goal seasons, pretty impressive. Never won the Cup. Oh, so close to that time with the Bruins, but wasn't meant to be. Who was on your line, Peter? I couldn't recall today as I was going through the names.
Yeah, well, I had Bruce McGregor,
right?
Teddy Irvin,
Ted Irvin,
and
right?
Myself, and we had some. I'll tell you, we look at some of the in one of the years, early 70s. That, you know, when I look at some of the numbers, our line, you know, we led the team in scoring. So we had some good chemistry. I played with Bruce in Detroit with the Red Wings, and Teddy Irvin, fellow Winnipegger. He was more of the guy who would go in the corners. He was the more physical of the three of us. And I was a playmaker. And Bruce had good speed outside, and I'd get him the puck. So those are the guys I played primarily with the Rangers were Teddy Irvin and Bruce McGregor.
Right, yeah. I was thinking Billy Fairburn, but I believe he was on Walter Tkachuk's line.
Yeah, he played with Tkachuk and Vic
Yeah.
and Davey Blon. When I came here, Davey Blon was around. He played with Tkachuk and Vickers, and then after Davey left, Steve Vickers jumped in and he played on that line. They call themselves the Bulldogs.
The Bulldogs, right.
Yeah, and Steve Vickers ended up, you know, coming here and being the Rookie of the Year, winning the Calder Trophy. So
he did.
That was a solid line, those three guys.
Yeah, and Dave Ballone, his hair was never messed up.
No.
Yeah.
He had it slicked back, and he was a character. He was one of the funny guys I played with. You know, that he'd lose his helmet or something with him, he'd be fixing his hair as he's skating down the ice, and had a great sense of humor, and I like I said, you play with so many people during the course of your lifetime, and you know, I'm at the point now where when we sit around with a bunch of guys and we throw a name out, and everybody's got something to say about, you know, but everybody, if it's a Davey Blon or, you know, a Jack Egers or a
yeah.
Bill Fairburn, a Walter Tkachuk, any of those guys, Eddie Jockeman. You know, we always have memories and something that happened or a good story about any one of those guys. And, you know, I still see, you know, we still have our golf tournaments with the Rangers. And we got one coming up on July 10th, the Coca-Cola Ranger Golf Tournament. So a lot of the alumni will be there. And then we have our golf tournament in September before training camp. And people like Walter come in, and Teddy Irvin will be there, and Billy Fairburn, and we just get together for a couple of hours and just tell old stories. So, you know the body's not what it used to be, but the memories are still there, and we still saw some great stories. So, it's good to get together with those guys occasionally.
Wonderful, yeah, Peter. The Rangers are certainly good with the alumni. That's one thing for sure. Now, when Emil leaves, they bring in John Ferguson. How did that change the atmosphere of the Rangers?
Well, first of all, we weren't winning, so, you know,
yeah.
When you make changes, it's because you're not winning. And I didn't have good, you know, when I played, when I broke into the league, John Ferguson was with the Montreal Canadiens, and I was one of these young kids that came in, and, you know, to prove myself, I had to drop the gloves on occasion. You know, I mean, they test you. They tested me back then. And one of the guys I had to go up against a couple of times in my early years with the Toronto Maple Leafs was John Ferguson. So we had some tussles where we dropped the gloves and went after each other. And, you know, I really think that carried on. I really do. And when he came and he joined the Rangers and took over the helm, and, you know, I knew what he had to do. He had to sweep out, you know, some of the older guys because we weren't winning. And he brought in, you know, the Wayne Dillons, and, you know, he brought in Donnie Murdoch, and, mm-hmm. you know, and those younger, you know, you have to bring those guys in. Pat Hickey, I understood that. And I for some reason, stood there. You know, I was still there. I'm sure maybe he tried to move me, but couldn't get anything. So I was a healthy scratch in a lot of those occasions, and I wasn't getting much playing time. I don't know whether the fact that because I was one of the older players or he just didn't like me from the times that we had when we had our battles on the ice, but he came in and wanted to change the character of the team, and he tried. He moved people around, brought younger guys in, and he kind of changed the whole old-school mentality with the Gilberts and, you know, the Hatfields and all those. Some of those guys were gone already, but he moved in the younger players, and he tried to make some changes. But, you know, I can say the John Ferguson side did not get along at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Yeah, I understand that, Peter. Now, you go to the L.A. Kings. You meet up with guys like Marcel Dion, Dave the Hammer Schultz. How was your time in L.A.?
Well, it was interesting because, you know, Ferguson was the guy that, you know, eventually I left. I went to law. It was an interesting year because, number one, my son was born out there, and that was special. And going to Los Angeles, where you could basically go anywhere and nobody knew who you were or what you did or you played for the Kings, who are they? You know, that's how the people felt out there. But I went out there for the year, and I ended up playing with Marcel Dion. And, you know, you mentioned the five or the ten people that I spoke about before when we talked about Emil Francis. Marcel Dion was one of the, I'm telling you, just a real class individual. He was the captain of the Los Angeles Kings. And, you know, when I came out there, I was married at the time, and my wife was expecting. She was 7 months pregnant, and I had a little girl that was only 3 years old at the time. And when I came out there, I mean, they welcomed me with open arms. I mean, Marcel's wife, Carol, helped my wife, Gail, get a place to live and situated us. And, Marcel had a place up in the mountains with a swimming pool, and any days off, he said it's an open house, and we had guys come over with their children and swim in his pool. So he was a tremendous guy. And, you know, at the time we had somebody named Jack Kent Cook who owned owned the team at the time. So we had those awful yellow and maroon jerseys.
Sure.
And, we were the most, I think we traveled, did like 40,000 miles a year. We were constantly on the road. So that 1 year was quite an experience for me, you know, playing in Los Angeles at the old Forum, the fabulous Forum, as they called it. Now they're at the Staples Center, but that it was a pretty good experience living in California for that one season.
Sure, I bet. Now, well, Peter, I tell you, it's been an honor and a pleasure speaking with you tonight, bringing up the memories of those great Ranger clubs. Certainly was wonderful for me. I thank you for spending part of your Sunday night with us.
All right, Bill, anytime. Thank you very much for having me.
You take care, Pete. Peace, Demkowski, folks. Next up, we'll talk to former Major League Baseball pitcher and outfielder Rick Ankiel. So stay with us, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form. and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 tonight on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. I'm Bill Donahue, taking you through the second part of the show here, enjoying Sports Talk 1240. I hope you are. We had a great conversation with Peter Stemkowski about the Rangers there. Really entertaining. Today the Mets get shelled, but still take the series from the Angels. The Yankees are down in St. Pete with the Rays. And we had the running of the Preakness Stakes in Pimlico. Pretty good sports weekend. Well, we'll move ahead. My next guest, he was a center fielder and pitcher. He played in Major League Baseball from 99 through 2013. For the Cardinals, the Royals, the Braves, the Nationals, the Astros, and, of course, the Mets. His new book is titled The Phenomenon, Pressure, the Yips, and the Pitch That Changed My Life. I welcome in tonight to Sports Talk 1240, Rick Ankiel. Rick, good evening.
How's it going?
Great to have you with us. Thanks for taking time out.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, let's talk about the early days, Rick. You grew up on the east coast of Florida. You went to Port St. Lucie High School. Who were your favorite teams and players back then?
You know, my favorite team was the Braves. You know,
okay.
Down here growing up, we had CBS. So just being able to watch them every night on TV. And then my favorite players, I was always a big fan of the young guys that made it to the league quick. So you look at Ken Griffey Jr., Dwight Gooden, Alex Rodriguez, Andrew Jones, guys like that, just they were getting to the big leagues. They were 19 or 20 and dominating at that young age. So as a young boy, as me trying to look up to players, thinking, man, I'd like to be one of those guys one day.
Sure, you certainly had a lot of success early. In high school, you had a great record. You had a 0.47 ERA. You were High School Player of the Year, as voted by USA Today. And then you go in the second round of the draft to the Cardinals. So you had some success pretty early yourself.
Yeah, no question about it. You know, moving up through high school, I was a small kid, and about my sophomore year I grew, and I went from throwing 84 to 94, and, you know, it just became evident that my fastest route to the big leagues was going to be pitching. And, you know, of course, I was drafted by the Cardinals and as a pitcher, you know, it didn't take me long. I made it to the big leagues my second full season, and the end of 99 there, I drafted 97, so my first year was 98. Then at the end of 99, I got called up, and all things were pointing towards a great career, that was for sure.
Definitely. Rick Ankiel with us tonight, Sports Talk 1240. Your debut in 1999 was in Montreal against the Expos. Your pitch, your first full season in 2000, and 11-7 record, 3.5 ERA, 30 games started, not too bad.
No, can't complain. You know,
right.
One thing too about that is I went 10 consecutive starts without a decision. So when you factor that in there, knowing that I had the lead, I mean, there was a few of them that maybe I didn't have the lead and the team came back and got it, but for most of those 10 starts through June, July, and August there, where that went through July and August, you know, I came out with the lead and really had a chance to win those games. But at the same time, I was on a pitch count, and as a young pitcher, they had me at the 100-pitch count mark, and, you know, I think as a starting pitcher, when you're coming out of the game in the fifth inning, because your pitch count gets up there, you can't really expect the bullpen to hold it for 6, 7, 8, 9. This was in 2000. Even back then, you know, I don't think the bullpens were becoming as big of a role as they are now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like you still had to make it into the seventh to really hold on to it now, where now you feel like they have that 7, 8, 9 guy and even 6, and they're ready to go into the bullpen a little bit earlier than they were back then.
Definitely. Great point, Rick. Now, people may not realize that you had a strikeout ratio of 9.98 for nine innings, which was second in the league to the big unit, Randy Johnson. And you allowed 7.5 hits per nine innings, which was second only to Chan Ho Park. And you came in second in the Rookie of the Year balloting to Rafael Furcal of the Braves.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, it even cut down that last month there. I won Pitcher of the Month. I went 4-0. I was really developed a changeup to go along with my fastball and curveball. That fastball and the curveball that I had were my two best pitches. And then really down that last stretch, the changeup just started to come for me. I started to be able to feel what I was doing with it. And now all of a sudden you gave me a third weapon. So going into the playoffs, my confidence was as big as it was all year. And I was feeling as good as I could have felt. Going in there with all three pitches working.
Right, 2000 postseason. Cardinals win the NL Central. Injuries to you and, well, the only people left are you and Darryl Kyle. And Tony La Russa chose you to start game one. Talk a little bit about playing for Tony La Russa.
Yeah, you know, Tony's the most prepared manager that I've ever played for. And, you know, his knowledge and understanding of the game and his understanding of the other team and what moves that they're going to be able to make with their bullpen or whatever is just was second to none. What a pleasure it was to play for him and understand how he did things and how he wanted things done and how he wanted to win. You know, and moving into that playoff, it was just me and Darryl Kyle. So when you look at how those playoffs were going to structure there against the Braves, one of us was going to have to pitch on short days rest. Mm-hmm. And the way that worked out, it was going to be whoever started the second game. So Tony gave me the nod to go ahead and start game one, which was a great honor. I was thankful for it. You know, at the same time, I felt bad for Darryl Kyle because he was the veteran on the team and he had a career year. And I felt like he probably deserved game one. But at the same time, with me going 4-0 coming down the stretch and then one of us having to pitch on 3 days rest, Tony felt that the veteran would be able to handle that better, which was Darryl Kyle. So, you know, is that the way all that played out, I understood exactly what Tony was trying to do.
Sure. Now, your performance started to deteriorate a little bit in that game, Rick. Talk about throwing the five wild pitches. How did you feel during that particular time?
Before the game, I felt great. I had some nerves, but nothing abnormal. I mean, everything you would have before pitching a big game. And
right.
First two innings went great. And then the third inning, I threw an inside fastball that just – it cut when I threw inside fastballs. They naturally cut anyway, but it cut in the pit, and the catcher missed it. And in the back of my mind, I thought, "Man, I just threw a wild pitch on national TV." And it really wasn't even that bad of a pitch. It's just it's the way it transpired. And you know, I pushed it out of my mind and just kept going. Said, "All right, no big deal," and just kept going. All of a sudden, things just started to unravel. So I spiked the curveball, then I started bouncing stuff off the back screen, and you know, really everything that I used up to that point, meaning mechanically, you know, when I got off track during the season or whatever, I always had a mechanical cue to get me back on, whether it was lead with my hip or my elbow or keep my weight back, all cues that pitchers have. Nothing was working. And I was, you know, at the time I was so young, I really just didn't understand really what was going on. And I even remember after the game telling the media, "Oh, it's a mechanical issue. It'll never happen again." I really was so young that I just didn't even understand what was happening.
Definitely. And then you go into the series with the Mets. Things continue to unravel. You lose that series. And did you ever hear of Steve Blass during that time?
I didn't see Blass during that time. Now,
no.
When I wrote the book, I talked to Steve a few years ago. And we sat down and had a great conversation. And, you know, really what we found was just how similar everything was as far as what, you know, what it does to you. You know, the thing about this is because it's something, you know, both of us have done our entire lives, be able to pick up a baseball and throw it as hard as we want, wherever we want, to one day having no clue how to even play catch some days. And it just consumes you. It's a 24-hour thing that just, it's just a revolving door that never goes away. It's always in the back of your mind somewhere thinking, how am I going to fix this? And am I going to have to throw tomorrow? And what am I going to do? And it's just a terrible, awful thing that I wouldn't wish on anybody.
Definitely. Now, for those folks who are unfamiliar, Steve Blass was a very successful pitcher in his own right for some really great Pittsburgh Pirate clubs, and he ran into the same problem as Rick with the inability to throw consistent strikes for some unknown reason. And both of them have that particular problem in common. Now, you had issues controlling your pitches from then on, Rick. Did they send you down?
Yeah, you know what happened is 2001 I came out and I probably threw about five games. And,
yeah.
And, they just weren't going well. And it seemed like it was getting worse. And, you know, then it was like, hey, it's time for me to go figure this out. So, yeah, I ended up go all the way down to rookie ball in 2001. And when I'm down there, I actually started to get it back. I started to feel good. I threw pretty well. They also let me DH twice a week just to try to get my mind off of pitching. So that was kind of fun, too. And
yeah.
Things were starting to get better. And you know, I had a good year, and it was exciting because now I went into the off season, even though it was only rookie ball. So what? I put up good numbers. The ball felt good coming out of my hands. So I go into that off season thinking, all right, good. I feel good. Can't wait till next year. I come back in 2002, and you know, during that off season, I was throwing a lot because I didn't want to lose that feeling. You know, I was like, hey, I need to keep throwing and keep understanding how this feels and what it's like, and my elbow got sore. I started to have elbow pain. So when I came out in 2002, they ended up shutting me down for the entire year. I had a slight tear in my elbow ligament. And they thought, hey, if we give you the year off and maybe it has a chance to heal, and then you come back and pitch in 2003. So I ended up missing that whole 2002 year because of an elbow issue.
Tommy John.
Yep.
Yeah.
So what happened was actually I didn't have the surgery in 2002. But in 2003, when I came back to throw, I started to throw, and then the issue just wasn't gone, and I pitched, I don't know, I think I threw into about June, and then my elbow finally blew out. And then I had Tommy John and had to rehab my way back and then made it back to the big leagues in 2004.
You sure did. We got Rick Ankiel with us on Sports Talk 1240 tonight. People may not know what the yips are, Rick, it's in the title of the book, Pressure the Yips and the Pitch That Changed My Life. There is some other examples of this, though. If folks may remember Chuck Knobloch with the Yankees, excuse me, or Steve, I think I have the yips, Rick. Hang on a minute. Steve Sachs with the L.A. Dodgers, and, of course, in New York, we remember Mackey Sasser. I don't know if you ever saw a film of him, Rick, but he would just continually tap the ball against his glove. Couldn't get the ball back to the pitcher.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and most of the times this shows up during those short throws, whether it's an infielder or a catcher or pitcher. It always seems like it's anywhere in that short distance, and I think what people can relate to is you know, in your golf swing, if you're not accelerating through your contact point and you're slowing down, you know, that's when bad things can happen. And sometimes with infielders or pitchers or catchers, when they're just trying to make that easy short throw and they're not accelerating through their release point, it seems like, you know, you can make a couple bad throws. All of a sudden you lose your confidence and now your body takes over to the point where you have these anxiety, your emotional system is doing stuff to you where even though you know exactly what you want to do, whether you want to throw it to the catcher or throw it to first base or whatever it was, your brain and your body just will not allow you to do it. It's the most bizarre, strange thing that there is. I think even when you look at it, the yips, the monster, the thing, there's not even a scientific name for it. That's how bizarre this thing is.
Exactly. You're exactly right. Brett Butler one time actually stole third base off Mackey Sasser because he couldn't get the ball out of his glove. It's an unbelievable situation, folks. Now, how did the circumstances arrive, Rick, that you become an outfielder?
So in 2005, you know, I finally just had enough of the pitching, and I understood, you know, just that wasn't a life for me to keep living. So I ended up going to Tony's office, Tony La Russa, who was the manager at the time, and retire from pitching. I go home. I'm not home an hour. I'm laying on my couch. My phone rings. It's my agent, Scott Boris, and I pick it up, and he's like, hey, how you doing? I'm like, ah, good, man. I feel great. He's like, all right, well, you ready to go play? And I remember saying to him, go play what?
Yeah.
He's like, go play outfield. I said, is nobody listening to me? I told you I'm done. I just retired from pitching. It's over. And he's like, no, I want you to be an outfielder. So I said, listen, I got to think about this. So I hang up. About 4 or 5 hours go by. I'm laying on my couch. I'm trying to visualize what I think this will be like, what I think it'll feel like, everything it'll take to take those steps to making it back as a position player or an outfielder. And then I get to a point where I visualize myself hitting a home run as an outfielder. And once that happens, Once I got that feeling and understood that, I picked up the phone. I called him. I said, hey, I'm in 100%. So he calls the Cardinals. At the time, the general manager was Walt Jocketty. He calls me and says, hey, Rick, listen, we're in 100%. If you want to take a shot at being an outfielder, we'll give you the opportunity to show up tomorrow. We'll get you a different glove, and off you go. We'll give you a shot at being an outfielder. And that's how everything took – that's when everything took off.
The rest is history, as they say. Now, another injury takes place with your knee to further prolong the situation. And 2006, I believe that was. 2007,
yep.
You go to AAA Memphis with the Redbirds there. You hit two home runs in a game against Nolan Ryan's Round Rock Express. Not too bad. Yeah.
You're right. I missed that entire 2006. But instead of letting it get me down, what happened was I came into spring training in 2006, and I was absolutely raking. I was covering the zone better than I had ever before. I was starting to hit off-speed pitches and recognize them better than I was before. And during that spring training, I ended up blowing out my knee. But the one thing it did was it gave me the ability to see how good I was actually getting. So I let that fuel me. So instead of looking at it like, oh, no, I'm going to miss another year, the way I tried to see it was, you know what? I seen what I can do. Now I see where this is going, and I used another year to at least lift my upper body and use the whole year to get stronger. So I felt like, all right, now I can put myself in a position to be strong just like position players, because as a pitcher, you just don't lift that way. You don't prepare that way. Your body's not in that kind of shape to go out and play every day. So 2007 went great. We had a hitting coach then by the name of Rick Eckstein, so I spent a lot of time with him just talking about what pitches were going to do to me, how I thought they were going to get me out. I really grew and learned. I mean, you move through that season down into August. I had 32 home runs with, I think, 123 RBIs, and then I got called back up to the big leagues in early August, which was just, for all the hard work and everything that it took to get me back to that point, it was just an incredible day in itself right there.
Oh, what a ride. Yeah. Now, you talk about August of 2007, Rick. Scott Spezio goes down with the big club, so the Redbirds send you up to St. Louis, and you start tearing it up there.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'll never forget the day I got called back up. I get the call, and we're way out on the West Coast in AAA, and it takes me all, it's a late flight. It's already midnight there, so we fly back and drive, and now I got to drive from Memphis. So I kind of missed BP, but, I for some days, the moment that I'm about to tell you would have been good enough for itself. So I get to the clubhouse, and just the high fives and the hugs, the welcome back from my teammates, from my coaches, from the organization. I mean, everything about that moment would have been exceptional in itself. Now we move into the game. We get into the seventh inning. I'm in a 2-1 count, and I'm facing Doug Brokaw, and he throws me a curveball. I get enough barrel on it to know, hey, I think this is going to be a home run. I know it's not going to go in the upper deck, but I think I have a chance for it to be a home run. So I'm running to first, looking at the ball, looking at the right fielder, trying to judge if it's going out. And the moment I realized it was a home run, I just had these emotions that exploded through my body. I mean, it was the most incredible thing ever. I felt like I floated around the bases on a magic carpet, couldn't feel my legs. Then I got the standing ovation the crowd. And
right.
I mean, just one of those things in my life that I'll just a magical moment that I'll never, ever forget.
Definitely. It had to be great feeling the support from the fans like that. That had to be tremendous. You even get some national attention, Rick, from Charles Krauthammer on the news talking about your situation in regards to Barry Bonds with his home run record. He called you the natural in returning to St. Louis, right?
Yep, he did. That was amazing. I never met Charles before that. When I read that article, the first thing was how well written it was. The second thing, it was just neat to see somebody in such a different walk of life pay attention to my story and actually write about it. So what a cool thing that was.
Definitely. Now, you hit your first grand slam, too, in St. Louis against Eddie Gradotto of the Reds. Broke a tie with Red Shandines for Tony La Russa as most wins by a Cardinal manager. So you were pretty much cruising at that point.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, now I'm back in the big leagues and enjoying myself, enjoying baseball again, and looking forward to showing up to the park versus when I was going through that throwing stuff. And, you know, there's some days where you just didn't want to go to the field because you knew it was going to be awful. But now all of a sudden you flip the script and you do the 360 and I can't wait to get to the field and everything's going great. My arm now all of a sudden, which is one of the bizarre things, too, I'm more accurate from 300 feet than I was from the pitching mound, which is 60 feet. But yeah, I mean, everything was going unbelievable. It was just what a neat time in my life that was.
Sure. Now, you were the Cardinals' leading hitter in spring training in 2009, but now another injury takes you down.
Yeah, you know, we were playing, I'll never forget, we were playing Philadelphia, and a ball was hit into left field, left center, and I was chasing it down, and I caught it. And right after I caught it, I went to take a step to try to slow myself down and kind of had a misstep.
Yeah.
And it threw me forward, and I just hit face first into the wall, you know, I'm lucky it didn't paralyze me, to be honest. I went face first. I didn't even have time to get my hands up, and my feet ended up coming up backwards and kind of touching my head from the opposite direction. So anyway, after that, it felt like my season kind of went down the drain. I never really felt the same, and it felt like I never really got over that injury. And, you know, unfortunately, that was my last year there in St. Louis. There was a young prospect they were bringing up by the name of Colby Rasmus. But it was what it was. You know, I'm always thankful to the Cardinals who gave me the opportunity to even try to be an outfielder, because if I'd have been with another organization, there's no telling if I would have even got that chance. So, you know, St. Louis is a special place that I'll always have in my heart. And, you know, but after that season, I moved on and just went and got a chance to play for some different organizations, which was neat in itself, too.
You sure did. You went on to the Kansas City Royals, and I was going to ask you about that. It had to be tough leaving St. Louis, the organization that supported you really through everything, through thick and thin, brought you back, and then they release you, and you have to go to Kansas City.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's one of those things where you're there's some parts where you're scared, and then other parts where you're looking at it like, hey, this is going to be great. I'm leaving the nest and I'm going somewhere else. You know, I was with the Cardinals for 11 years. And, you know, now I get a chance to – I didn't go far. You know, I went right over to the Royals. I'm still in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but things are different. Now you're playing for a new organization. And you know, at that time they were in a rebuilding process. We really weren't that good. But one thing that happened that year that was just, you know, an unbelievable thing for me – you know, coming towards the trade deadline, I really got hot and played really well. Well, I got traded to the Braves. And I grew up a Braves fan. I grew up down in South Florida with TBS, so the Braves were my team. And now all of a sudden, I'm getting a chance to play with Chipper Jones and play for Bobby Cox. And these guys are some of my childhood heroes. So while I was in Kansas City, you know, it was just a tough time. We were losing. You know, I wasn't used to it. The fans weren't like St. Louis. It's not like we had a sellout. And then all of a sudden I got traded over to the Braves. Well, it was like the baseball heavens opened up and shined a light on me. I mean, just what a incredible thing that was to be able to go over there and help them try to win it and push through the playoffs. And, you know, I ended up hitting a big playoff extra inning home run with them in San Francisco.
Right.
And when you even think about that, that was my next time in the playoffs. Well, the time before that in the playoffs when I got the yips and started throwing balls all over the place was against the Braves.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden my next time in the playoffs is with the Braves, who's my childhood team. And I hit this extra inning walk-off home run and for Bobby Cox and all these things. And it's just sometimes one of those things you look at and you wonder how these things happen. I don't know if it's divine intervention or what it is. I don't know. But it's just an amazing, incredible journey when you take the 360 and look at it.
For sure. Now, for folks who may not remember, that walk-off home run that Rick hit went into McCovey Cove. And the only other person to hit a ball into McCovey Cove at that point was Barry Bonds.
Yeah, exactly. So
yeah.
You put all those things together, and, you know, it was one of those nights. My wife was in the stands, and we were pregnant with our first child. And, you know, there's two things that you can do as an athlete in a stadium. And one is you can do something where you hear 60,000 people absolutely going crazy, and the sound is almost deafening. Or you can take 60,000 people and make them sit on their butts and so quiet that the only thing you can hear is your dugout screaming because you just did something that made them go quiet. So
yeah.
It's one of those moments.
Great point, Rick. Rick Gankiel with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, the Braves decline your option and send you, you're a free agent, and you end up signing with the Nats, who are the subject of my nightmares these days. How did it feel getting released by the Braves and having to go over to Washington?
You know, I was going to be a free agent, so I wasn't sure if they were going to sign me back or not. Obviously, as growing up and them being one of my favorite teams, I was hoping that they did, but they didn't. And then we go over to the Nationals, who were in a rebuilding phase, and you know what? It was pretty fun. I enjoyed my time with the Nationals. Right before I signed there, actually, Jason Wirth had just signed his big deal there.
Oh, yeah.
He called me in the offseason and said, hey, I know they're looking at you. I'd love to have you over here just from playing against you all these years. I know who you are as a player, as a competitor. So if you want to play here, I'd want you here. And then I ended up going there, and I played there 2 years, and they got good quick.
They did, yeah.
They did. And that 2012, they ended up in the playoffs. And I just think Mike Rizzo, the general manager, you got to give him credit. I think he put a lot of pieces together really quickly. They did good in the draft. They brought in Steven Strasburg. They brought in Bryce Harper. And you just got to look at where they are now. And that's a credit to him as well, because he's the one who brought those guys in there.
Definitely. Talk a little bit about your time with the Mets, Rick.
Yeah, so, in 2013, I actually started with the Astros.
Right.
And they were really young. Jeff Luhnow went over there, who's the general manager. And same thing, they're in that rebuilding phase, and they were super young. So when I went to the Mets that year, it was actually a blessing, just because we weren't winning, but it was a veteran team. I grew up down here in Port St. Lucie, Florida, where the Mets spring training is, so I'm very familiar with the organization.
Uh-huh.
And I always wanted to play in New York. You know, it's one of those things as a player where New York's kind of that huge media, New York's New York, so it was a chance for me to play there. I enjoyed it. I liked my time there. Unfortunately, we didn't win. And my time there was short. But, for me, growing up in Port St. Lucie, Doc Gooden, who was one of my guys I looked up to when I was young. I mean, he just came into the league dominating. So, when I played for the Mets, I actually wore number 16.
You did.
I was available in his honor. So that was another cool experience for me. It's just one of those things where you look at and shake your head and wonder how you got to that moment, but it's definitely something I won't forget.
What made you want to tell the story now, Rick?
I had offers to write a book and to even make a movie when I was still playing, and the timing of it just wouldn't have been right. For one, as an athlete still in uniform, there's no way I could have opened up like I did, and I wouldn't have been ready to just reveal all that. I feel like, as an athlete, you're always taught to have this game face and never show your emotions and never let anybody get into what you're doing. When you talk about the greats, they always talk about, oh man, this guy was a gamer, he has ice in his veins. Well, to sit down and write about everything and reveal everything that I was going through, the anxiety and all that, I just wouldn't have been able to do it. And once I retired from playing and realizing that, similar people are going to go through things similar, whether it be a player or in other professions, because even when I went through the throwing stuff, I remember getting letters from people in different walks of life, whether it be a writer or an announcer, or a violinist, or a field goal kicker, you name it.
Yeah.
So I understood that my voice could help people who were going through the ups and downs of life, the roller coaster that we all ride. I remember when I went through the throwing stuff, I read a book by Lance Armstrong about his battle with cancer and just how much it inspired me. And I felt like, if I can just inspire one person like that book inspired me, then it'll be worth it. And up to this point, it's been very therapeutic and rewarding. I've had a lot of people reach out to me and thank me for telling my story and saying, hey, I've been through something like that, whether it be personally with the family stuff or something like that on their professional level. So it's been great.
Outstanding. Well, Rick, I tell you, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to be with us. The book, folks, is called The Phenomenon: Pressure, the Yips, and the Pitch That Changed My Life. Get it on Amazon. Go down to Barnes & Noble. And Rick, it was wonderful having you with us.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Have a great night.
All the best. Rick Ankiel, folks. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Peter Stemkowski and Rick Ankiel, my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you on Sunday, June 4th. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.